the unsurpassed, penetrating,
and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself.
Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So, good morning, or good afternoon. I don't think anybody, it's good evening yet, but it's really nice to have you all here. And I hope that my talk today will be helpful. In Buddhism, we say that the human world is this great, if not best, opportunity to do something positive and transformative with our lives. Also, most of us humans realize early on that human life is fragile, impermanent, uncertain, and not long in duration. Given this opportunity and the impermanent nature of life, it makes sense that we would want to get on with the matter of doing something of value with our lives. As we all know well, it isn't that simple, though. The way that life goes, we learn from trial and error, mistakes, and good actions and good decisions. Time and experience are great aids and teachers. Each of us has a story with twists and turns, ups and downs, joys and sorrows. The book of our life isn't over until our last breath. Our opportunity to do something with our lives is always there. So I'd like to start this talk a little bit by telling you some of how I became a Buddhist monk. So this is not because it's anything special or especially unique. My story is just my story. And of course, I can only give you bits of it because stories have all these things that go on in them. But the thing about the story I'm going to tell you is it's what brought me to the monastic life, to becoming a Buddhist monk. And I want to make it clear before I get into my story that the path of a monk is not everyone's path. And that's good, because otherwise we might not have a functioning world. Everybody lived in monasteries, nobody married, no one had children, no one worked at jobs. That wouldn't be a very functioning world. Monks are not higher or better than other people. As your lives, my life will only be of value to myself and other people if I continually live it as best I can to benefit all living things. And of course, in that process, I'm going to make a lot of mistakes. So here's my story. All my younger life, I was an athlete. I lived and ate sports, as they say. I remember writing a letter to someone in my freshman year in college in which I said, I don't know what I would do if I couldn't play football. Kind of crazy, huh? I was a young kid. In football, as many of you probably know, sometimes guys get badly injured, and that ends their career. At this point in my young life, I wanted to play professional football. I wanted to play it in Canada because I knew I wasn't big enough or good enough to play in America in the NFL. Now fast forward to my sophomore year in college. We're about four games into the season. We lost our last game pretty awfully. It was a nightmare. Everything went wrong. So as was customary in those days, we scrimmaged full contact in practice that next week. So that's the next week after this loss. I'm playing defensive end in a live scrimmage. I cross the line of scrimmage, headed to the backfield. All of a sudden, I get hit in my right knee by a guy going full speed. He just came flying into me, and he took my legs out from under me. I fall to the ground. I lay there for a bit, and then I get up very slowly, and I'm not walking so good. The knee area is really not painful yet, but this strange feeling shoots through my body. I never quite had this before, that something is really wrong. Long story short, after trying to play with a taped up knee for 2 weeks, constant whirlpools, water on the knee, blocking knee, all kinds of problems, I was sent to a doctor finally. He was a knee surgeon, in fact. He bent my knee in ways it shouldn't go, and he said, "You gotta be kidding. You need knee surgery, and you need it now." So I had the knee surgery, and this was in the days when there wasn't arthroscopic surgery, so besides the surgery, they had to do an enormous cut, and that causes problems in itself. It was a long recovery. I think they told me to lift weights with my knee. I tried that once, and I felt like my knee was getting ripped apart, so I went to the swimming pool, and I couldn't swim. I had to just hold the side of the pool and kick my legs. Actually, I couldn't kick my right leg very good at all, but you know, I just worked it up, and I rehabilitated for almost 11 months. In fact, I had to, I was in a cast for 4 months, full cast, crutches, no weight bearing, and then when I got the cast off, I had to learn how to walk again. So, you know, it was a bit of a deal. I was young. Okay. So, as it turns out, I couldn't play football for 10 to 11 months. I got the cast off. I was really loyal to the rehabilitation and built up my leg, which had atrophied in a cast in 4 months. But my world was a little different than it had been before. I couldn't play football. You know, I could be on the sidelines. I could watch people play, but I couldn't actively play, and definitely couldn't do any contact. So during this time, I began to look at other things. And I took a religious studies class on racial injustice, and I think in the Vietnam War, and just basic problems of the day. This was 1969, I think. Okay. And this my sophomore year, so I took a bunch of classes that informed me about what was going on. Also at this time, the military draft was instituted. So as a young person, you felt like your life was being, it wasn't yours. You know, you had a draft number, and it just depended on what number, what birthday they pulled out of the barrel, in what order. I went to college in the South Bay area, and I was raised in San Francisco, actually fairly close to the Haight-Ashbury. And again, the time I'm talking about here is 1969 to 1970. And you know, as I began to look around more and more, you couldn't help but realize the world was spinning and changing around you, and there was a lot going on. I remember going over to Berkeley a few times. My brother went to Cal, and I went over with him, and I was just blown away by all the stuff. You know, all the stuff that was going on. But what I tried to do is educate myself about the things that were happening and try to become aware. And as I did this, I realized that I had lived a pretty sheltered, uninformed life up to now, and that the world was much bigger, and that there were a lot of problems surfacing. So I rehabilitated my knee for that 10 to 11 months, and I came back and I played in my junior year, but my heart wasn't in it. And in fact, I was a step slower. I began to realize more and more that football is a really violent game. And did I really want to do this? The way it is, you either hurt people or you get hurt. And also in those days, I don't know how it is now, because that was long ago, but there was a lot of mental intimidation and posturing, which I became less and less a fan of. So I played out the year kind of half-heartedly. And during that time, I let my hair grow and my beard grow, which was a no-no in those days in football. So the coaches used to come up and pull my hair and tug on my beard, and which was growing. But, you know, they had a good time with me. And that year, also in school, I took more classes on what was going on in the world, racism, Vietnam War. And then I took a class on that dealt with Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi and the practice of nonviolence. And this was to have a real impression on me. And as a consequence of that, I got involved in the nonviolent anti-war movement. The more that I studied nonviolence, the more I believed in it. It really made sense to me. So I marched and I protested, and I did some nonviolent, whatever we call it, you know, actions. And I got thrown in jail, usually for a very short amount of time. But, you know, when you're, I mean, jail for any amount of time is not a great experience if you've ever been there, okay? So to go back a little bit here in my junior year in college here. So this is my junior year. I decided to quit football. I'm a peace protester. I also, in that year, had the great fortune to go to a class where Reverend Master G.U. Kennett was speaking. She was down at our college in a rural religions class to speak about Buddhism. And I was really impressed. Okay. She struck me as a person who was kind, compassionate, and wise. Not arrogant, very intelligent, and yet, you know, just like an ordinary person. So she ended up coming up a number of times and down to the university in my junior and senior year, and the professor that taught this world religions class knew that I was very impressed by her, and he would let me know that there was going to be a class, and she was coming, so I would go. And one of these times he invited me out to lunch with Reverend Master G.U., another monk who'd come down with her from the abbey, this Jesuit priest, and myself, and we went to the faculty club for lunch. Oh, we must have been a sight. So here's two bald-headed Buddhist monks, a Jesuit, and a kid with long hair, a beard, and probably wearing overalls. So I had these two threads going on, an active participation in the peace movement, and a growing interest in Buddhism and meditation. That year, I had the opportunities, this is my senior year in college, I had the opportunity with one of my friends who was writing a paper on Buddhism to visit the Abbey for a long weekend. And this again made a real impression upon me. It wasn't easy. Sitting in meditation, you know, everybody sat on cushions with crossed legs in those days, and my knee was up in the air somewhere. I couldn't get it down. But you know, I was really impressed by what was going on. And there was something that, this impression that I was left with that I couldn't shake. By the end of my senior year, the war in Vietnam wasn't ending. Okay, we had all hoped that through our protests and actions that the war would end. Okay, and there were various glimmers of hope, but it wasn't ending. Okay. And I remember going to a large South Bay Peace Movement meeting. A few people were drunk at this meeting, and a number of people were rowdy, and the tone of the meeting, at least as I took it, was cynical and on the negative side. You know, I mean, I couldn't blame people. Everybody was tired of the war going on. We wanted it to end, and we thought that we could potentially do that, and it wasn't happening. We hadn't stopped the war. So many Vietnamese and American soldiers had died. It was just tragic, the whole thing. But I left that meeting, and in the following days and weeks, a little disheartened with the peace movement. It seemed to me that it had gone negative. Of course, this is my impression. I don't know that that's 100% true. I know there was a lot of really dedicated people there, many of who continued on in their work for world peace after the Vietnam War had ended. But at least for me, I thought there's got to be something more. There's got to be something different. And above all, I wasn't at peace. So fortunately, I had this other thread. I had Buddhism and meditation there for me, and I just went right to it. So to make my long story short, in a little over a year, I came to the Abbey for a stay, looking towards becoming a monk. And I'll tell you, my lay training, 6 months, I mean, things moved along a little quicker in the days, but it was quite difficult. One time I had it with it, you know, I wanted to leave, I had it. So fortunately, I ran into this very wise monk who sat me down and he said, "Well, you can leave if you want, but you just have to come back." And I thought, oh yeah, I'll just have to come back. So, 12 intensive purposes, I stayed. Okay, I knew he was right. And as I say, things moved along much quicker in those days. And, you know, within 6 months, I was ordained. So, I'm so grateful to be a Buddhist monk because it's the right life for me. It's right livelihood for me. Over the years when things are difficult, or, you know, I'm in a slump, I reflect that this is the best life for me, and I should make the best use of it. And I just go on. Again, I will say that everyone has their best... choice for their life and livelihood. So each of our choices is our own and it is different, and that's great. So, let me move on here a bit. So recently, Congressman John Lewis died. And John Lewis was a black congressman from Georgia, I think, who was involved in the peace movement from the time of a very young age. I think he may have started with one of the groups who were trying to do something about the situation, the racist situation in our country, when he was 14 years old. You know, but he started at a very young age. So with John Lewis's death, American Experience, which is a PBS branch, re-showed a documentary on the Freedom Riders. You know, many of you may know what that is. And I watched that, and it left a real impression on me, not only about John Lewis, but about all those people, black and white, young and old, who participated in that summer of 1961 in the Freedom Rides in the South. So John Lewis was an amazing person, dedicated to the civil rights movement and nonviolent protest. He was also a great legislator who fought for liberal causes in our Congress. The Freedom Rides took place from the late spring through the summer of 1961 on both Greyhound buses and Trailways buses. They went from Washington, D.C., and their final destination, if they were to make it, would be New Orleans, Louisiana, in the very deep South. The Freedom Riders themselves, which I say John Lewis was once, were of a mixed age. There were some really young people involved in it. A number of them had been seminary students. But there were also people in their mid-30s and a few people up into their 50s. They were black and white, women and men, and they were extensively trained in nonviolent protest tactics before they set out on the Freedom Rides. And the Freedom Rides were sponsored or run by CORE, C-O-R-E, the Congress of Racial Equality. And the idea was that these buses with the Freedom Riders on them would ride into the Deep South to challenge the Jim Crow laws that were still in place in a number of places in the South, which are actually had been found unconstitutional by this time in our history. And on the way, they would, let me take a step back here. So with in the South, in a number of places, with these Jim Crow laws, if you were black, you were required to sit in the back of the bus. The Freedom Riders were going to sit mingled. They were going to sit in the front of the bus, some of the black Freedom Riders. In parts of the South, there were still whites-only waiting rooms at the bus stations, whites-only bathrooms, and then there'd be colored bathrooms, always of an inferior quality. And there would be drinking fountains, black and white, lunch counters, black and white, and sometimes only white. So they went. The idea was they would ride into the South and challenge these unconstitutional goings on. So the night before they left on the bus to start their journey, many of these Freedom Riders wrote out a last will and testament. They knew that what they were about to do was serious business, and they were risking their lives. So with this first group of Freedom Riders who went into the South, started in Washington, D.C., with the destination, ultimate destination being New Orleans, there were two buses. One was a Greyhound bus, one was a Trailways bus. And they proceeded deeper and deeper into the South. Okay. One of the buses got to a bus terminal in South Carolina. John Lewis got off one of the buses and headed to the white-only waiting room because they came to challenge these unconstitutional goings-on. Well, when he walked into that waiting room, he was met by some, most likely Ku Klux Klan, just dressed as ordinary people, not in the Klan outfits, but they were there in the waiting room. They knocked him down, and then they beat him. Fortunately, after a while, the police who were in the vicinity intervened, but he was pretty well beaten. And one of the police officers, asked a bloody John Lewis laying on the ground if he wanted to press charges. John Lewis said no. We are not here to cause trouble. We are here, for people to love each other. So in my casting about with this talk and trying to read up on the Freedom Riders and look on things in the internet, I came across an Oprah Winfrey that celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Riders. Many of them were still alive. So they came on the show, this Oprah Winfrey show, and then there was also a gentleman who came on the show who was the person who beat John Lewis, you know, this 50 years ago in South Carolina. And it turns out that this gentleman had come a couple years before the reunion to Washington, D.C., to John Lewis's office, and he asked for an apology. He apologized, and he asked for John Lewis's forgiveness. And John Lewis said, "Yes, I forgive you." And they hugged and they cried. And John Lewis said on this Oprah Winfrey piece that this was the only person who ever beat him who apologized. because he got beaten quite a few times. And it was very, very touching to see these two men who knew each other now on this Oprah Winfrey show, holding hands, honestly caring about each other. And apparently this man, over the years, what John Lewis had said to him about didn't want to press charges, they had come in peace and love, just kept ringing in his mind. And he actually changed. He became anti-racist. And he spoke out about things. So back to the buses. So the buses proceeded further into the south, and they were met with some hatred and violence, especially when they got into Alabama. One bus, when it came into Anniston, if I'm saying that correctly, this is a bus rest stop at a smaller city outside, what's the bigger city? It's a smaller city on the way. Anyway, they came into Anniston to a rest stop. Well, when they came into Anniston to the bus stop area, there was a crowd of people there. And the people had baseball bats and pipes and all kinds of stuff in their possession. And they started to break the windows on the bus. And then somebody slashed the tires on the bus. Well, the bus driver, got the bus back going again and got out of there. But the bus didn't get very far because the tires just went flat. And this crowd of angry people was following them. Okay. And then the bus was just stuck there again with all the angry people around him. And the crowd began to break the windows. Yell all kinds of nasty things at them. Shake the bus. They were trying to turn the bus over, but weren't successful. I mean, it's really violent. And then someone in one of the broken windows threw in some rags that were burning. He probably had doused them in gasoline before he threw them in. So he throws them on the bus. This person throws them on the bus. And the bus starts to catch fire internally. The Freedom Riders who were in the bus, and actually there are other people on the bus besides the Freedom Riders, but everybody's gasping for air. And the bus is smoking inside. Then the gas tank explodes. Okay. This is actually a blessing in disguise, because when the gas tank blew up, the crowd that was outside sort of dispersed. Okay. Then the second gas tank blew up, and the crowd dispersed even more. And the Freedom Riders and the other people on the bus were able to get out of the bus and get into the fresh air. And miraculously, no one was killed. They were suffering from smoke inhalation, and some of them were, they needed medical care. Another touching thing that happened at this time. So where the bus stopped after its tires were slashed was near this grocery store. And it happened that the daughter of the people that rode the grocery store, she was 12 years old, saw what was going on, and she was just appalled. So when the Freedom Riders and the people on the bus got out of the bus, she proceeded to bring them water and hold them up. 12-year-old girl, okay? And it was of great help to them. She also appeared on this Oprah Winfrey show. Some of the Freedom Riders called her their angel. She and her family paid for it. The Klan was not happy with what she had done. They didn't hurt her physically. I'm sure that the family was intimidated and eventually had to move out of town, to move somewhere else. Okay. Okay, so that's one of the buses. There's another bus. And it's heading further in Alabama, and they didn't crisscross. I mean, this second bus didn't know what had gone on with the first bus. So this second bus, just follow me, see if I can figure my notes here, because I ad-libbed there. Okay. Oh, so the second bus arrives in Birmingham. So it's Anniston is outside of Birmingham. That's what I was looking for before. But the second bus arrives at the bus station in Birmingham. Well, little did they know that, and if I remember this correctly, local law enforcement and Bull Connor, the local peace officer, had made this arrangement with the Klan that when that bus got into that station in Birmingham, they had 15 minutes to do whatever they wanted with those people on that bus. I mean, it's horrific. But it seems that this was planned ahead of time. So that bus comes into Birmingham, and these courageous freedom riders get off that bus and they proceed into the white-only waiting room, and they're beaten. They're beaten quite badly, and all kinds of people are beaten. People, news reporters who are there are beaten. Klan's people got beaten because people mistaked people for other people. It was crazy. And it went on for only 15 minutes, but, you know, as we all know, a lot of damage can be done in 15 minutes. And the police came in, and the crowd that had beat up these people exits. It was interesting because it was a Sunday, and a number of these people who had come to do something about this bus that arriving were still wearing their Sunday best. Strange world. Okay. But with both of these instances, the miracle is no one was killed. And the people needed a lot of stitches, got knocked unconscious. Ghastly stuff. I mean, this is both the black and the white freedom riders, male and female. It didn't matter to people who they beat. And some of them had to be hospitalized, and that's a whole other story because the hospitals weren't all that keen on helping them initially. So these two incidents happen. People are kind of thinking that's the end of the Freedom Riders. You know, we put that to an end. That's not what happened. The buses kept coming. So throughout that summer, 400 plus people, Freedom Riders, 400 plus Freedom Riders, rode into the Deep South, rode again into Alabama, and eventually got thrown in jail in Louisiana. So there were 400 people in men's and women's jails in these places, and you know, they were in jail for 30 days, some of them, and they just stuck together and gutted it out. Okay, well, this began to make the news. John Kennedy is in presidency at this time. His brother is the Attorney General, Robert, and news gets to Robert, and Robert actually sends somebody down there who, you know, really sees what's going on, gets the news back to them, and then they're able somehow, Robert Kennedy does something with whoever's in charge of all these posted signs at busing stations and lunch counters and all that, which is totally unconstitutional. He gets that department to take down all those signs. So ostensibly all those signs came down in the South. I don't think it was that simple, or even that they came down meant it was end to a lot of the stuff, but it was something, okay? And this was all the result of these courageous people and their nonviolent action, because they never did they strike back at anybody when they were being beaten. So it's remarkable. Story. And if you're a documentary junkie like me, okay, Freedom Riders is on American Experience, PBS, and you can watch it. Not during the retreat, but after. Okay. Okay. So John Lewis, you know, continued to fight on for racial equality. He became a congressman, continued to fight for racial equality. He also fought for justice for everyone in America. Okay. He was a ferocious advocate for people's civil rights. And he also strongly believed in nonviolence. If you've seen pictures of him, there's a presence there, and I was like, whoa. But apparently, he was also a very kind, nice, gentle man. He left many people with that impression about him. So he was fierce, but he was kind. And as I say, he really believed in nonviolence. Before he died, he wrote this essay. So he died recently, it was the end of July. And he wrote this essay, which he asked to be published on the day of his funeral. So I'm going to be reading this from a New York Times article, in which it was published, time of his funeral, and I think the funeral was like on July 30th or something. Okay, so this is John Lewis. "While my time here has now come to an end, I want you to know that in the last days and hours of my life, you inspired me." So he's talking about Black Lives Matter here, the Black Lives Matter protest. "You filled me with hope about the next chapter of the great American story when you used your power to make a difference in our society. Millions of people, motivated simply by human compassion, laid down the burdens of division. Around the country and the world, you set aside race, class, age, language, and nationality to demand respect for human dignity. That is why I had to visit Black Lives Matter Plaza. Black Lives Matter Plaza that he's talking about is located in Washington, D.C. There's been ones designated in other areas of the country, but this is the one in Washington, D.C. So, "That is why I had to visit Black Lives Matter Plaza, though I was admitted to the hospital the following day." Because he visited shortly, he was admitted to the hospital and he dies. "I just had to see and feel it for myself, that after many years of silent witness, the truth is still marching on." Okay. "When you see something that is not right, you must say something. You must do something. Democracy is not a state, it is an act. And each generation must do its part to help build what we call the beloved community, a nation and a world society at peace with itself. Though I may not be here with you, I urge you to answer the highest calling of your heart and stand up for what you truly believe. In my life, I have done all I can to demonstrate that the way of peace, the way of love and nonviolence is a more excellent way. Now it is your turn to let freedom ring. When historians pick up the pens to write the story of the 21st century, let them see that it was your generation who laid down the heavy burdens of hate at last, and that peace finally triumphed over violence, aggression, and war. So I say to you, walk with the wind, brothers and sisters, and let the spirit of peace and the power of everlasting love be your guide." So I think John Lewis really offered to people what we call in Buddhism the gift of fearlessness. He gave hope to others. He behaved with compassion, kindness, patience, and moral uprightness. Okay? And I think he's pretty inspiring. Okay? So I'm realizing now that I've already talked 40 minutes, but I think I have to talk a little bit more. Here's my talk, and I'm sorry. I hope this isn't too long. Okay. So the Buddha was a great teacher of nonviolence, ahimsa, non-harm. It's part of Buddhism. In the Dhammapada, and I'm quoting from Gil Fromsdale's translation here, the Buddha says, "Hatred never ends through hatred. By non-hatred alone does it end. This is an ancient truth." And then there's a second part of this pair of sayings that often people don't see with this first part, and it says, "Many do not realize that we here must die. For those who realize, this quarrel ends." Impermanence. The Buddha also says in the Dhammapada, All tremble at violence. Life is dear for all. Seeing others as being like yourself. Do not kill or cause others to kill. If desiring happiness, you do not use violence to harm living beings who desire happiness. Then you will find happiness after death. So the Buddha teaches us to practice love and compassion to all beings rather than hate and violence. All beings means not just our friends, but equally to our enemies and those who seek to do us harm. Okay, so, that's one of my regrets about the peace movement, because we really got into othering people. There were the good people, the peace people, and then there were the administration people, and we were not very kind to the soldiers who fought in Vietnam, the American soldiers, and I regret that. So one of the spokes of the Eightfold Path is right livelihood, as you all know. Right livelihood is concerned with ensuring that we earn our living in a way that does not harm others. It's very much ahimsa, non-harm. As Bhikkhu Bodhi writes in his book, The Noble Eightfold Path, the Buddha teaches that wealth should be gained in accordance with certain standards. One should acquire it only by legal means. One should acquire it peacefully, without coercion or violence. One should acquire it honestly, not by trickery or deceit, and one should acquire it in ways which do not entail harm and suffering for others. So as many years ago, we were having a retreat here, and there was a gentleman at the retreat. Let me say this first. We were having a retreat here, and I did one of the discussions, and it turned out that a lot of the people who came to the retreat were in the helping professions. You know, I presume that meant nurses, doctors, counselors, psychologists. I actually wasn't sure what it meant, but figured those were in it. One of the retreat guests got up his courage to speak and said he felt badly because he was a business person. He wasn't in the helping professions. Well, you know, that didn't strike me as quite right. So I responded that it makes all the difference when you come across as a decent, honest, helpful person when you're dealing with others in a business. That's a helping profession. Okay? Buddhism is very wide in terms of right livelihood. Just this tiny list of right livelihood. So many jobs in our world help other people. Non-harm, honesty, and wanting to benefit for others are the criteria. We offer service to each other, and for this we should be grateful. Although society, business, and commerce assign values and wages to the different types of work we may do, it seems a bit backward to me, the way this all is. We offer services to each other. You know, society would not work if we didn't offer these services to each other. If people didn't harvest our food during this pandemic, we would be in sad shape. Look at all the caregivers, hospital workers who clean and disinfect, the ambulance drivers, let alone the nurses and doctors who have risked their lives in cleaning and taking care of the COVID sick. Then there are the essential services, bus drivers, mail deliverers, postal workers, food producers, food packers, people who deliver our produce, grocery stores. I mean, there's all kinds of things here. So this list goes on. To me, this all comes under the category of what you would do with your, to me, this all comes under the category of what you do with your life matters. Not everyone becomes a politician. Obviously, not everyone wants to be a Buddhist monk. For many of us, and I say this includes me as a Buddhist monk, there's no grand gesture in my life. There's just my everyday life. But as great Master Dogen said, everyday life and enlightenment are one and the same thing. He also taught that wisdom, enlightenment, are about four ways of living out our life. These four, as we know, are charity, generosity, giving, tenderness, tender speech, loving kindness, compassion, beneficence. We can find wide ways to help beings. We can be of service to our world. Sympathy, putting ourselves in the place of others, seeing that we're not separate. Okay? We may be different, but we're not separate. Thus, we would want to practice non-harm and compassion to all beings. Again, the Buddha says in the Dhammapada, and this is from Gil Fromsdale's translation, not by matted hair, not by clan, not by birth does one become a Brahmin. The one in whom there is truth and Dharma is the one who is pure, is a Brahmin. So that person is a Brahmin. The Buddha lived at a time when there was a very strict class system in India. He did something revolutionary in the monastic order. And anyone who entered the monastic order, who you were or what class you were, it didn't matter. You could be admitted. And there was no class system within the monastic order. And as we also know, he further admitted women to the monastic order, which was another quite revolutionary thing to do at that time. So to this day in India, some members of the Dalit class, they prefer to be called this, the Dalit class means the oppressed class as opposed to the untouchables or the lower class. So to this very day, people from that Dalit class convert to Buddhism because they feel it is the only classless religion. And it is important, and it is converting to Buddhism is an important step in reclaiming their self-worth and confidence. So in many ways we have a caste system in America. There have been some improvements, and there's a long way to go to undo this type of thinking. The teaching of the Buddha offers us a way to improve and transcend the situation. All beings have Buddha nature. All beings deserve respect, generosity, and kindness. If we give people opportunities, if we view them with worth, the worth that they deserve, if we extend ourselves beyond what we are comfortable with, change continues to happen. Although ours is a world of suffering, we can do something to bring about an end to suffering. We can help lessen it. I think I'll leave these other stories for the talk after. So, I'd like to end by saying that whether you are young or old, well or sick, brightly alive or dying, what you do with your life matters. Making a difference on this earth is largely about what we do in our everyday life, how we live out our lives. It's never too late and definitely never too early to live in harmony with other human beings and to live in harmony with our surroundings. I think Buddhism offers us a way in to this. The Buddha's teaching is not mere passivity. The Buddha taught restraint in regard to unwholesome things and activity by the way of good conduct in deeds, words, and thoughts. Whether we act or don't act, our actions have consequences. We are the owners of our karma. We have a means and a responsibility to make this world a better place. We can all help build what John Lewis called the beloved community. Or isn't that what the Buddha Sangha is? Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.